Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon into understandable everyday terms for just regular folks. And our goal is to build understanding about the law and to clear up some of the mysteries about our legal system. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today we're having a special edition of our podcast to address Judge Aileen Cannon's dismissal of the classified documents case in Florida against former President Donald Trump. We'll delve into the guts of this decision, explore how unique the decision is, and try to project for you some of the next steps in the case. So let's jump in. Are you ready to jump in there, Judge Gail?
I am surely ready, Judge Tom. Let's get it in.
So let's go a little bit into the background of this situation and sort of stage set for you. Monday, July 15th, federal judge Aileen Cannon in Florida dismissed the classified documents case against Donald Trump and his two employees because the appointment of the special prosecutor Jack Smith, according to Judge Cannon, was unconstitutional. She issued a 93-page ruling, which came less than 48 hours after the attempted assassination of the former president, and just 2 weeks after the Supreme Court gave the president great immunity through its Trump versus the United States immunity decision. So this ruling of Judge Cannon was really a result of a long-shot motion filed earlier by Trump's defense team. Nobody thought it had a chance. And the judge had 2 days of hearings on the motion in June, but decided to issue her ruling just yesterday. So we decided to have a special edition of Next Witness, Please, to try to explain this everybody's calling a shocking decision and try to break it down in plain language. First, we should note that this is a highly controversial decision and one that goes against every other court decision that's examined the issues of special counsel appointments. Judge Cannon said the appointment of the special counsel, Jack Smith, by Attorney General Merrick Garland was fatally flawed because it was not based on a specific federal statute. And we'll break this down for you. Secondly, she had a second reason in her opinion. She found that the position of special prosecutor was improperly funded through the Treasury Department. Judge Gail, both of these things are unprecedented, and I know that's a word we seem to be using, overusing throughout following these cases, but what's your overall reaction to all of this?
So I think most of us are actually much like the president's defense team, who's was actually absolutely shocked by the decision. As you mentioned before, they filed this motion, but even given what some others may prospectively believe to have been maybe favorable treatment toward the defense during the life of this case, it was largely understood and viewed that the defense did not believe that this particular motion, this motion for a dismissal, had enough merit to it that the court would grant it. What we want listeners, I think, to understand is that filing motions to dismiss indictments or dismiss charges is a fairly common practice, particularly when there are criminal charges that are pending. So to file the motion is not uncommon. And again, many times the motions are filed with the expectation that the court is going to deny or not grant or not permit the indictment or the charges to be dismissed, either in whole or in part. But nonetheless, it is considered an exercise or a form of aggressive defense. And in doing so in the client's best interest, it seems nothing different was done here, both for the former president and his co-defendants, in that the filing of the motion seemed fairly perfunctory, if you will, or it was kind of standard for what you would expect. But again, no reasonable expectation that the motions would actually be granted. Now, they did expect, I can determine and discern, that defense did expect that some of their other motions would not only be granted hearings, but that there may have been merit to those motions because they went to more of the substance of the case, not the appropriateness of appointing the special prosecutor, especially given the history of special prosecutor appointments that America has seen that takes us back, multiple
decades. And embraced.
Decades. Yeah.
Yeah, and embraced.
And without question, right? And we had not really, there never before been, kind of a challenge to the status or the appointment of special counsel because we've been here before, right? We might not like the way this blanket feels, but it is kind of comfortable in that we've had it on us before. We've experienced this. And that's what I think. My reaction is kind of actually similar to perhaps that of the defense team. Like, oh my gosh, we actually scored a win when we weren't even really planning for a win. We were planning for a loss on this one, but we'd have to focus our attention perhaps on the more meritorious arguments.
Since you and I started this podcast, we've talked about various motions before Judge Cannon, and we talked about motions to suppress and all kinds of other motions to dismiss. This decision specifically, she said in the decision, that all of those other motions are denied because they are moot, which means, if you're reading the decision, folks, moot just means that they don't have to be decided. She's not ruling on them. They don't have to be decided because this decision was overarching and dismissed everything.
And indeed, and also that it now means, well, those motions essentially have no more meaning. There's, in her view, no more of an active case. And because that case is not active, then we don't even have to discuss those. We don't even have to address them. We don't have to acknowledge them. And here's what I'll tell you. I think many folks who have been following this case have actually been watching to see what would happen on some of those other pending motions, because there had been motions to dismiss that had been placed before the court before. And although they were not successful, I think there's been some concern that the judge absolutely could essentially gut the case, or she could issue a ruling that would actually foreclose future prosecution of this particular case on the merits, which was what
a ruling at trial.
A ruling at trial that would have made it very, very problematic. Because in fact, in one of her prior opinions, she actually invited the defense to raise the issue again, of dismissal again, but during trial when double jeopardy would have attached, and it would have not only, used this analogy with someone recently, it doesn't just close the door and slam the door to prosecution. It like closes the door, slams it, locks it, and welds it shut in order to foreclose prosecution.
One thing I want us to make clear right now, and I think this is going to be confusing for our audience, but maybe you can jump in and clarify it for us, Judge, is that this decision applies to the Florida cases only. The D.C. cases, which we talked about in depth, Judge Chutkan's going to have a monumental hearing to decide what's left in those cases after the Supreme Court's immunity decision. But this decision on special counsel does not bind Judge Chutkan, correct?
Oh, absolutely not. It And in fact, the Supreme Court's ruling in the immunity case actually provided specific instruction to Judge Chutkan to, as we discussed in the prior prior episode, to essentially, you know, create a test to determine essentially the lifeline of this case. And so Judge Cannon's decision is unto its own. Now, of course, that does not stop the defense from using the decision in the Florida case as a defense and to buttress a similar motion in Judge Chutkan's courtroom in D.C. You can absolutely expect that the defense, having won a motion they did not expect at all to win, and given this 93-page ruling that was issued, I think some of which the language, which is also called dicta, or the language out of the ruling from Judge Chutkan, from Judge Cannon, was lifted out of the recent immunity decision out of the Supreme Court from Justice Clarence Thomas. And so you can believe, and I promise you, you can bet that that 93-page decision out of Florida is in part, maybe in whole or in part, is going to be used as a basis to argue to Judge Chutkan in Washington, D.C. that she should essentially follow suit. Don't bother with that test or the instructions that the U.S. Supreme Court gave you to determine whether or not and what type, if any, immunity the president enjoys in that matter. Just take the easiest route, which is to adopt a Judge Cannon's rationale and dismiss the case out, all the way out, and don't even bother ruling on the merits of those motions, because it's the same special counsel. It's the same prosecutor.
Let's take this to the next step. Let's say Judge Chutkan in D.C. decides the opposite of Judge Cannon. Then you've got two circuits
competing decisions.
You've got two judges competing against each other, which sets up a conflict, which, you know, those conflicts are the kind that are resolved by the Supreme Court. So this case between D.C. and Florida, these cases, I should say, set up almost a certainty that the Supreme Court will dive into this.
Indeed. And again, this was an issue that, although it was not before the Supreme Court previously, there's at least been, you know, we can at least look to the court and we know the position and the likely outcome, at least for one justice. We don't know the other justices' position or opinions on this, but you're absolutely right. When you have conflicts in laws, and particularly to the issues related to the Constitution, which is what essentially the heart of Judge Cannon's opinion was, which was this was an unconstitutional appointment because the United States Senate did not confirm Prosecutor Smith, and that the United States Constitution has an appointments clause, and that appointments clause, in her view and in her based on her rationale, it was violated. And because it was violated, then Prosecutor Smith could not be legally appointed because he had not been essentially vetted by the U.S. Senate, and he had not been confirmed by the Senate, although his appointment came through U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland. In the view of Judge Cannon, the appointment by A.G. Garland is not sufficient to satisfy the appointments clause of the United States Constitution. What's more, is she even went a step further and said that even in light of in all of that, the funding of the office of the special counsel through the United States Department of Treasury, because the original appointment was flawed and violated, in her view, the appointments clause, then the funding of that office through the United States Treasury is also flawed, because there can be no funding through the U.S. Treasury without a proper appointment in the first place. And so that means the appropriations clause is also violated, again, in her view.
Let's go into a little bit of the history here to show what an outlier this decision is. Really, we can go back to the 1970s, and if you recall, during Watergate, there was a special prosecutor appointed by the name of Leon Jaworski. He was a special prosecutor, and a challenge went up on several matters to whether or not the President Nixon at that time had executive privilege over certain items and tapes, if you recall. And Warren Burger, who was Chief Justice at the time, Chief Justice Warren Burger, said in the decision that Congress has vested in the Attorney General the power to conduct the criminal litigation of the United States. So courts have historically relied upon that Supreme Court ruling way back in the 70s to uphold the appointments of special prosecutors. Then there was a statute that talked about the appointment of special prosecutors. This was done by the Congress, and it was a Special Prosecutors Act that went basically, it lapsed, for want of a better term. It lapsed after the special prosecutor's case against Bill Clinton and the Whitewater case in the 90s. But was there a need for additional legislation by Congress? Well, the courts said no, that in fact, the power vested in the Attorney General to conduct the criminal litigation of the United States was enough for him to appoint special prosecutors. And this was challenged most recently in the Robert Mueller case. Remember when he was investigating the connection between Trump and Russia and the 2016 election? And also David Weiss, who has brought charges and obtained a conviction against President Biden's son, Hunter Biden. So this has been a long history of special counsel being appointed and, you know, taking place, whether there was the Independent Counsel Act or whether it was inferred by the Supreme Court decision and Warren Burger. But it's interesting, Judge, that she got beyond this in a very strange way. Yeah, she tried to blow up this history in what I think, and that's my opinion, a very strange way. She said that the appointment of Jack Smith is different from all the others because he was a private citizen appointed to operate with little oversight or supervision. And she went back to that Watergate decision, and she said the Supreme Court assumed but didn't decide, those are her words, assumed but didn't decide that Attorney General had the power to appoint a special prosecutor. What do you think about that?
You know, that's pretty stunning because I don't know that there's anyone who's a constitutional scholar whoever reads a Supreme Court opinion and says, well, I think they're just kind of guessing here. I don't think they're pronouncing anything. And so I would actually disagree, respectfully disagree with Judge Cannon on that point that in the Watergate case, the Supreme Court just made the assumption that the Attorney General had the power to appoint special counsel. I would definitively say Prosecutor Jaworski was emphatically appointed, and the Supreme Court made it clear through its dicta, through its language, through its opinion that no, not only is this a proper appointment, that again, that independent counsel act is not necessary because the AG is necessarily vested with the authority to do this work. I think it's also kind of challenging to the mind to think that each time the AG's office determines that it has a conflict for whatever reason, or for whatever reason they determine a special prosecutor is necessary. And let's say it's a conflict of interest. Let's say it's something that, so as to preserve the integrity of the case and the investigation, they appoint someone that is detached from the Department of Justice, that they would then need to seek permission from the U.S. Senate to determine who that objective individual is. That's kind of thunderstriking. And given the slow pace with which Congress already works, can you imagine how many cases, just from a practical standpoint, can you imagine how many cases will just be left in limbo for either practical or sometimes maybe even political reasons, with there being no appointment of special counsel if that were the requirement of the AG every single time they determined a special prosecutor or the appointment of a special prosecutor is necessary? It just introduces so many other bureaucratic loopholes that the framers did not intend and that the Supreme Court has previously spoken to and said it is not a requirement of the Department of Justice to seek the approval of the Senate because of the powers inherent to the department itself. That is just stunning.
You're being nice and you're being very straightforward with your explanation, and I appreciate that. Let me just say, I am appalled by the audacity of this federal district judge, a newbie to the bench, interpreting and assuming that the Supreme Court of the United States, you know, back in the 70s, did not rule on something. Now, Judge Cannon's taking her lead from Clarence Thomas, sitting Supreme Court Justice, in his concurring opinion in the immunity case, which echoed this same logic. But she's a district court judge. She's a trial judge. You and I were trial judges.
Indeed.
It would be like me sitting in a trial court and saying, well, it's my opinion that the Supreme Court of the United States did not rule on this, and they only assumed, and therefore they left the door open for me to rule on this.
Right. Now, I could actually see some defense attorney, right, perhaps arguing that to the district court, like, hey, judge, you have the authority to make a different ruling, because in my reading of this,
you've heard those arguments.
Yeah.
You've heard those arguments.
Yes, And I could nod all along and say, no craps this time, because I am not about to substitute my judgment for that of the U.S. Supreme Court from many, many decades ago, from the 70s, and we're in 2024. What I believe, now here's the thing, is I would be telling an attorney, hey, listen, I believe the court was very definitive. And not only was it definitive, it's actually created a longstanding precedent upon which we have relied and acted upon many times over. So since Watergate to today, special counsel has been, and special prosecutors have been appointed by the U.S. Department of Justice many times over, relying on this same precedent. And I cannot be convinced that our U.S. Supreme Court left this door open for however many years. And by the way, how many times do you believe this issue was before the court and they've not clarified it or sought to clarify it? They haven't, because there's not been a need to, because they were definitive when they spoke to it the first time. There was no
assumption. Even more recently, Judge, in the Mueller case situation, Robert Mueller's special prosecutor, you know, his appointment was upheld by two district courts and the D.C. Appellate Court.
Mm-hmm. You know? Which is considered like the step before the U.S. Supreme Court. It's like the baby Supreme Court.
So it's not like this is a unique position. or a unique argument. This has been argued before and thrown out.
Exactly. And so that's why I just kind of wonder, well, I don't really wonder how we got here, because again, if you have a currently sitting Supreme Court justice who, you know, unrequested and without any, you know, prodding and without even the specific issue being before them, just decides to throw out in the middle of everything else, oh, and by the way, I just don't, you know, believe that the special prosecutor was duly appointed, then that sometimes acts as signaling to other judges. And I believe in this instance, this may have actually been the case here, that Justice Thomas's opinion, his concurring opinion in the immunity case, provided strong signaling, almost like swallowing a bullhorn, to Judge Cannon in Florida, because this is the very issue that was before Judge Cannon in this particular matter. And Justice Thomas, without this being something that was argued or vetted in the Jack Smith case.
It wasn't even an issue.
It wasn't an issue. And you know why it wasn't an issue? It wasn't an issue in the Jack Smith case because, just as you said, it's already been resolved. It's already been addressed multiple times.
They didn't bring it
over.
Up in the immunity argument. Didn't even bring it up.
And there was no need to, because, as you said, you already had the issue of the special counsel resolved by the two district court opinions, as well as the DC appellate court decision. And so that matter never went to the US Supreme Court because A, it was already resolved. B, it wasn't even brought up in the immunity case. And C, this has already been the standing practice of appointment. And so there was no reason to disturb it until now.
Okay, let me jump in here, and this is going to be hard to explain, and Judge, you can help me out here. I'm trying to break this down so our audience, which we're dedicated to serve, can understand this. She based her part of her decision on, as you mentioned earlier, the appointments clause of the Constitution. And basically, and I'm paraphrasing and breaking this down in simple language, the Appointments Clause says that departments of the executive branch, you know, any department, but here we're talking about the Department of Justice, that the head of those departments as part of the executive branch can appoint inferior officers, that's the term that's used, to conduct business, and that's totally within their parameters. In the past, special prosecutors or independent prosecutors, however you would like to call them, have been considered inferior officers. Now, she jumps to the conclusion that they're not inferior officers, but instead she finds that they are, quote, principal officers, end quote. And she bases that because they have a degree of independence. And because they have that nonpartisan independence, the whole idea behind a special prosecutor, she claims that because principal officers need to have Senate approval, that Jack Smith needed Senate approval before he could start being a special prosecutor. And because he did not have Senate approval, all the money his office has taken from the Treasury is also unconstitutional because he had no authority to do so. Now, she says there are two ways out of this. One is that Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, should have put the appointment of the special prosecutor to the Senate for confirmation. That's one. The second way, she says, is Congress can pass specific laws authorizing the Attorney General to appoint special prosecutors. All right. So that's the status of things.
And wouldn't you
Judge
agree?
Gale, what, in my opinion, number one, there's no way in hell Congress is going to pass any such legislation.
Well, you definitely won't get it through the House. Even if you just by some slim margin get it through the Senate, it's never going to get through the House. But again, there's no need to, because the court has already spoken to this and said that this power is inherent
in the power to handle the criminal litigation of the United States.
And this is what's given to the AG to do just that. What's more is actually, I think that there is at least to some degree some agreement between Judge Cannon and Jack Smith as to the issue of principal officer, right? If this is the argument about him being a principal officer, Jack Smith doesn't argue that if it were a principal officer, that principal officer would require would require Senate confirmation. His argument actually has been that he and his team are not principal officers. So that the judge, even if her rationale is correct with regard to a principal officer, that it is flawed as applied to him and his team, because they are not principal officers, and largely because they still operate under the guidelines, under the authority, and under the direction of the Department of Justice, and specifically the Attorney General. Take, for example, the fact that even before this decision, even with prior decisions, and Judge Cannon is not a stranger to having her decisions appealed. They, especially in this particular case, they've been appealed many times.
And being thumped by the 11th Circuit Court.
Well, they have been returned to her for corrective rulings. And so, but in each instance, the special counsel actually is required to consult with the department and with the AG to essentially obtain permission to appeal these matters. If that's in fact the case, then I think that there's truly a flawed argument that one is a principal officer when they are not, at least to this degree, permitted to make independent decisions on even if they will appeal a decision. In this instance, Prosecutor Smith has sought permission from DOJ to appeal this decision from Judge Cannon. Again, I would argue not the behavior of a principal officer. So they don't disagree on perhaps principal officers requiring Senate approval. The issue here is that, yeah, you just don't have a principal officer in front of you. You have special counsel that's independent, but they are also governed by those same guidelines from the DOJ and AG.
And Merrick Garland, the AG, has said that, yes, special counsel are independent, but they still have to operate under DOJ, Department of Justice, guidelines. And ultimately, the Attorney General could veto any action of the special prosecutor.
Absolutely. So that is not a principal officer. Let's be clear. And I don't know how the judge would be able to make any determination as to the amount of oversight the special counsel or the independent prosecutor is provided by DOJ. And is there a certain metric for that? How do you measure that? What is sufficient? It seems so very subjective that would be the case. And if, in fact, you have one judge deciding that this is enough oversight for them to be considered independent, but this is not enough oversight for them to be independent, this would change. I think, every time the weather changed, you'd have, some competing ruling coming out of some court somewhere, because perhaps the judge doesn't like, how much oversight a particular prosecutor or independent counsel is being given by DOJ. That to me sounded really wonky and very, very difficult to measure.
Judge, if we could go back and just look at this, clear back to Jaworski and Mueller and Weiss, the targets of special prosecutors And also during the Clinton days, Ken Starr. Mm-hmm. The ideas of special prosecutors, the targets of their investigation are usually presidents or presidents' families.
True.
So if you are a principal officer and one either have to have congressional authority to appoint or at least Senate confirmation, how does one take the politics out of this equation? Because the politics goes directly in the face of the independence of the office.
I actually think it's the converse, just what you said. It's essentially taking a needle and injecting politics into this. And by so doing, I think you also make the public very skeptical of the independence of the Department of Justice. And quite frankly, in these circumstances, the independence of the court.
So where does this leave us? You mentioned, and rightfully so, that Jack Smith's office has asked permission from the Attorney General to appeal this to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. And for our listeners, the nation is divided into circuits for the intermediate level courts of appeals. Those circuits are a combination of states. And for example, Ohio is in the 6th Circuit, which is Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee. Florida is in the 11th Circuit, which is housed in Atlanta. That's the next step. He will appeal this decision to that court. There will be, at least initially, a 3-judge panel randomly assigned to hear this case. What are we talking about time-wise, Judge? What are we talking about process-wise? Where does this go from here? What are next steps?
Well, this matter is going to go to the 11th Circuit for appeal. There's going to be a decision out of that court eventually. There's certainly going to be time provided for the parties to brief this matter. And I'll pause and say, although we know that Jack Smith is appealing directly to the 11th Circuit, under, I would say, most other and normal circumstances, and Judge, I'm sure you had this experience when you were on the bench, I sure did, is anytime I issued a ruling that one party or the other was not happy with or was against a party, it was not uncommon for them to immediately file a motion for the court to reconsider or to reverse itself or to look at it again and to step away from it. In this instance, there is no motion to reconsider being filed to Judge Cannon. No. And in likelihood, from the perspective of Jack Smith, Prosecutor Smith and his team, is because they already have kind of a history and familiarity with this court that they understand that that would be futile at best. Just
a waste of time.
Not a good use of their time. Absolutely. And so they are immediately appealing to the 11th District, which, by the way, they've appealed to this court several times throughout the life of this case. And on several occasions, this court has returned things to Judge Cannon and noted the incorrect logic and reasoning of her case. Now, here's what I would suspect, that they're going to send it to the 11th Circuit. There's going to be arguments. One side or another is going to be unhappy. And then the appeal is going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court for a couple reasons. It's going to go there because obviously there's great challenge to the rationale and the reasoning and the decision originally made by Judge Cannon. But as you properly said earlier, you're more likely than not going to have a competing opinion and decision that comes out of Judge Chutkan's court that is going to affirm the appointment, perhaps, of Special Prosecutor Jack Smith and note his proper appointment, as well as the history of appointments of special counsel. And that is going to create the conflict that can only be resolved by the U.S. Supreme Court. The appellate court, even in Washington, D.C., will not be able to resolve this to the degree of national satisfaction that's necessary, because you can't leave an opinion in place from one court that says the independent special prosecutor is fine in this case, but for the same essential reasons and purpose and the same guidelines under which they serve, they're not okay in another case in another state, but appointed by the same U.S. department. That is, that's just a recipe for disaster. So that's how that path is going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, remember, in the meantime, though, none of this has any bearing on any of the state-led prosecutions against former President
Georgia,
Trump.
Georgia, New York.
None of them. You know, again, what's necessary is certainly to resolve this issue at the federal level. But what we do want listeners to understand is that this has zero impact on any of the state-led prosecutions that the defendant, that defendant Trump or former President Trump faces in these instances. And those, of course, those courts are free to make their decisions. It doesn't mean that state court decisions can't end up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court for some reason or another. But it does say that at this juncture, the only cases that would be affected by this are the federal cases.
For Supreme Court watchers out there and legal pundits, you know, they're going crazy over Clarence Thomas's concurring opinion that basically was a blueprint for Judge Chutkan.
You mean Judge Cannon?
Or Judge Cannon. Thank you. Thank you. Judge Cannon for issuing her opinion. Was Clarence Thomas foreshadowing the decision of the Supreme Court? Was he saying, okay, some federal judge out there have enough guts to follow my concurring opinion? It'll make it up to us, and we'll support you. We've got your back. I'm telling you right now in my concurring opinion that the majority of us, the like-thinking people on the court, agree with you. What do you think of that proposition?
Again, that's one of the issues that really perhaps gives me cause to pause, because that's that form of signaling that I spoke about earlier. And when you have a justice that's speaking to an issue or a concern that isn't even raised, that's not properly briefed, it hasn't been argued before the court, nothing. So that means that necessarily the decision or even the opinion of Justice Thomas, at least on its face, you know, kind of reeks of bias and lack of objectivity, because the prosecution never had an opportunity to weigh in on that specific issue.
No,
because it wasn't before the court.
Wasn't before the court.
And so that tells it, and that goes back to, if you will, that concern for recusal. If the justice signals in advance without providing the fair opportunity to both sides to argue a point that is so imperative and so integral and is so central to the case, and you don't give both sides the opportunity to argue it, yet, without being asked, you issue an opinion that speaks directly to that issue, then,
oh, by the way, yeah,
it clearly says, hey, I got an opinion about, at least I have an opinion about it. And I don't know that we can go as far as to say that the other conservative-leaning justices share that opinion. What I will say is that as we've been here today talking about precedent and talking about the longstanding history of appointing independent prosecutors for specific cases, what I am convinced of, or at least what I've seen so far from this court, as this Supreme Court as currently constituted, they essentially have no qualms with abandoning longstanding practice. They will overturn precedent in favor of their whatever their rationale is in the moment. And that this
the Dobbs case, the Voting Rights Act case, the Chevron case overturned.
We've seen it happen so many times. And so they're, at least in my view, if they're minimally they're signaling from Justice Thomas as to what his opinion is about this issue, even unasked. Does that mean that he has a majority of his colleagues that share that same opinion? Maybe, maybe not. But I certainly, I wouldn't be betting that that's not the case given the history of this court so far. So it causes me to struggle, but it also triggers that same issue we should be perhaps talking about, and we did before, which was the issue of recusal. It means that at least in an instance like this, were the case to return to the Supreme Court, Justice Thomas should be the first, in the interest of integrity, should be the first to recuse because he wrote an entire opinion about an issue that wasn't before the court, and he's clearly signaled what his position is without giving the other side a fair chance to present their position to the court. That is the antithesis of what a fair justice system should be and what it should look like. And what's more is it wouldn't be surprising if the case is reinstated and Jack Smith asked Judge Cannon to recuse, because this is absolutely, I think anyone who just has a baseline understanding of, ethical principles and fairness in this justice system, I think all of them would agree that this kind of cuts against what we expect from our judges and our justices.
Well, I think just on that last point, not to belabor it, but I think people are watching to see in the appeal to the 11th Circuit whether Jack Smith will specifically ask the 11th Circuit to remove Judge Cannon from the case, given her abysmal track record with that appellate court of making wrong and flagrant decisions in the case. Some people think he might do that. Other people say he won't and go back and ask her to recuse herself. I don't know, but that's going to be an interesting thing to watch.
And he's been amazingly patient throughout the life of this case as it relates to the court's rulings.
Painfully so.
And you know what, though? I will tell you, and you probably know this even as a defense attorney, I certainly knew this as a prosecutor, how important it was to create a record of certain experiences and incidences and how important it is to not kind of jump to conclusions just because, it's the very first time the judge doesn't rule the way you want, your response is going to be, get rid of them. That can't be the case. But what Jack Smith has done, I think actually pretty masterfully here, is he's kind of walked through this case and he's taken quite a few of them on the chin from Judge Cannon for the purpose of creating and preserving a record that demonstrates what he'll likely argue is bias, lack of objectivity, and a clear proclivity to either gut the prosecution's case or to curry favor with the defense, which is not consistent with what judges should be doing in these instances, no matter who the defendant is. Because I promise you, there's some defendant out there somewhere that's like, hey, give me a judge like that, that's going to turn themselves essentially into a pretzel in order to make this better or easier or less onerous for me, or essentially to hand me the win without handing me the win. That's the desire of just about any defendant that walks into a court anywhere wanting a favorable outcome. And they're not likely going to get it. And what people, I think, are looking at in this instance, and it is inescapable, is whether or not the defense is experiencing benefits unearned because of who the defendant is. Because we have a justice system that prides itself on being blind and applicability across the board to everyone, no matter who you are. And I think there are folks, just average run-of-the-mill, everyday folks from every kind of walk of life, that is being reminded that if this were them, if they were the ones in this courtroom, they could probably bet on not receiving what is perceived as preferential or favorable treatment. And that's the thing that continues, I believe, to erode faith and trust in this justice system, but also gives us the great opportunity here to decode it and to help to try to infuse faith in it through understanding and appreciation for processes. Because as we always say, Tom, people don't trust what they don't understand.
They don't understand.
If they understand what's happening here, that will be eye-opening, but I don't know that it will necessarily infuse trust. And what I want them to understand is that this is one judge. What we want to do is stray from painting everyone with a broad brush, because that's not every judge everywhere. But all you need is, you know, one person to kind of overshadow everyone. And that is certainly, you know, whoever's making the headlines, right, can overshadow everybody else. And I think that's exactly what's happening here. We hope to be able to turn some of that around by educating listeners so that they can understand process and hopefully what to expect next. Although we don't have a crystal ball, so I can't tell you what the Supreme Court or even the appellate court's going to do. We could tell you what the process kind of would instruct them to do and hope for the best. And we all have to watch together and decode together.
I want to just leave on this last note. Congressman Matt Gaetz from Florida came out yesterday. The opinion came out yesterday. We're tape recording this on Tuesday. It came out on Monday. Matt Gaetz, congressman from Florida, says Lincoln will be Trump's next appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. That kind of statement bothers me as it relates to the judiciary.
Absolutely. And insofar as, yes, that may not be a surprise to many, it is heartbreaking to those of us who are members of the bench and members of the judiciary, because we certainly do pride ourselves on the work that we do. And I, for one, were it me, I would like to know that, you know, my recommendation to the Supreme Court is one that has been earned because of the way that I have taken care of following the law and not showing fear or favor to anyone.
Your judicial record and your scholarship.
Absolutely. Not because there's even the slightest specter or whisper that I've curried political favor in order to do that. That's heartbreaking, because judges, by and large, we really do honor the work that we do. We understand the importance of the judiciary as a whole without regard to the levels in which you serve. And we understand how people rely so heavily on the fairness and objectivity of judges in their daily lives that this just cheapens it potentially. And especially when, again, you have like someone from another branch of government kind of foretelling this, it really does cheapen the work that judges, the hard work that judges do every single day in every corner of this country. And I just hope that that's not the case for the reasons that we've outlined here. I hope that, you know, no one's doing anything so that they can better themselves without regard to how it impacts everybody else.
Judge, big appreciation for jumping on just 24 hours after the decision.
That's what a special edition is for.
but I think it was important, as you said, to explain this to people in as understandable terms as we can.
Indeed.
You know, people don't trust what they don't understand, and that's our mission.
Mm-hmm. And we really do hope that we've built some understanding out of some complicated situations and decisions, and also understanding its applicability. Again, I don't think folks are far off when they're thinking that, you know, this may not be the experience they have if they were similarly situated, and that sometimes this can really give the perception or perspective of favoritism. And we really do hope we can restore your faith in the judiciary and educate you an awful lot along the way. So don't forget to tune in. Listen and subscribe to Next Witness, please. You can catch us on any of the podcast platforms where you get your favorite podcasts. You will find us, and we look forward to continuing to serve and educate you.
In addition to all of your favorite podcast outlets, we're also on the NPR Podcast Directory, the National Public Radio Podcast Directory, so you can check us out there. If you have questions or comments about our podcast, you can email them to me. My email address is hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, @ohio.edu. Also, if you have a question about the law or a case that we've been discussing, you can also shoot us an email and we'll make sure we try to answer your inquiry in one of our upcoming episodes. Next Witness, Please is produced by WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and also our audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real soon with our regularly scheduled episode. We hope to get that out to you late this week or early next week. So stay tuned for that. Judge Gale, it's always a pleasure.
Judge Tom, the pleasure's all mine.
Have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.